You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
I'd just like to just impose upon you just for hopefully for just a few minutes, and I want to pick up on the question of frontier that Neil introduced for us. The frontier, of course, in places like what was Coast Salish territory and now is British Columbia, entailed, of course, some very violent processes of dispossession. It entailed the making and the remaking and the elimination of a whole series of property relations. And that's what I want to think about when I think about processes of gentrification. When we talk about gentrification, in part, we're talking about a process by which urban property relations are made and remade. In other words, when we talk about gentrification, we're not just talking about real estate, we're also talking about real property. We're talking about property in land and all the dynamics that go with it. So gentrification and broader processes of urban redevelopment frequently entail, for example, the erosion or the elimination of state property. So massive council house sell-off in the UK, for example, the squeezing and the elimination of social housing subsidies in Canada. It also can entail the reworking of the rental property market. The elimination of the process of expulsion from SROs, of course, entails an expulsion of tenants and perhaps ultimately their replacement by property owners, full-scale property owners. The process of gentrification also can entail the elevation and the hardening of private property. The discussion, for example, about the ambassadors, I think, is an example of that, where the imperatives of private property become increasingly prevalent. I've also tried to make the argument in the context of the downtown east side that the process of gentrification, in one sense, constitutes a process of enclosure, an enclosure of a commons that has been produced and co-produced through many generations of community struggle and activity. When we talk about property, however, we shift the terrain in some very important and, to my mind, problematic ways. There's a very dangerous tendency to regard property in the sense that I've talked about it, the sense of property rights and ownership and so on, as something that is, in a sense, off limits. We're not really allowed to talk about property. It's beyond our purview, it's beyond our control, to the extent that it appears rooted in what we might call the private domain, as opposed to the public domain. And this can affect our political and our ethical stance in some important and problematic ways. Consequently, processes of gentrification, which are driven by largely, or which appear to be driven largely by the private sector, albeit with state involvement in very important ways, can consequently easily appear to be a somewhat apolitical process from the outside, something over which we have no direct control. If state action is implicated, of course, it becomes easier to mobilize. It becomes easier to invoke rights. Rights are a very powerful tool, but as my colleagues here will, I'm sure, point out, rights are frequently invoked in relation to state action, not private action. So the courts will tell you, hopefully they'll change their view, that the Charter is basically a document that protects you against the state. It doesn't protect you against non-state actors. And of course, that isn't to say that we don't rework that and push on that point, but the generalized tendency seems to be a bracketing off of certain domains of public versus private action. And this all sounds a bit abstract, but I was reminded of this the other day when I led a field trip, as I'm sometimes asked to do, in Strathcona and Chinatown. Now, Strathcona is a very, very interesting place in the kind of collective imaginary around Vancouver and urban change. And as many of you may know, in the late 1960s, Strathcona was the target of a remarkable project of mass expulsion. It was, however, a state-driven project of mass expulsion, a process which would have entailed the expropriation of a vast swath of private property and the remaking of property relations, where a large population of owners would have been turned into renters, state renters, and would have been allocated state housing. Strathcona, like the downtown east side, was targeted and demonized. It was dysfunctional, it was marginal, it was decayed, and it was an urgent need of intervention and surgery. In this case, of course, the process was to be that of urban renewal, which I'm rather alarmed to see has now come back up in the gentrification context. And of course, the story in Strathcona is a heartening story because it prompted a mass uprising, remarkable mobilization with groups like SPOTA and groups in Chinatown and elsewhere, forming really very creative alliances, jumping scale, connecting with the federal government, and using a language very much of rights and justice, the argument being that urban renewal was inherently discriminatory because it was targeting a population that was 70% Chinese Canadian, and it was also inherently destructive to the extent that a viable community, which had been starved of resources, was going to be destroyed in a very misguided process. And of course, SPOTA and other groups won. Now that saving of Strathcona, saving now perhaps for another round of gentrification, but that's by the by, is now part of that sort of self-congratulatory story that we tell ourselves about Vancouver. Right? What a marvellous place Vancouver is, because we, in fact we didn't, but some of us did, we saved Strathcona. It's one of the nine great decisions that Mike Harcourt et al. Have in their wonderful book called City Making in Paradise, along with other sorts of rather interesting initiatives. Think now about the Downtown East Side. And think now about the remarkable similarities to the Strathcona experience and the remarkable dissimilarities to the Strathcona experience. The problem being that it becomes, I think, somewhat harder to generate that same language of wrongdoing, of an abrogation of rights, of targeted discrimination in relation to a market-driven process of expansion, of expropriation and expulsion, as in the case of the Downtown East Side. At least in Strathcona, the residents could stay. The Downtown East Side, the residents don't get to stay unless they're lucky enough to get a room in social housing or co-op housing. So a language of market-driven change, I think, in the Downtown East Side makes it all the much harder for us to respond and to invoke a language of rights, to invoke a language of justice. Think what would happen, for example, if the city of Vancouver decided to expropriate the hotels, as I've often wondered why they don't, because in fact we paid for them many, many times over through welfare payments. Think what would happen if the city, of, you can imagine the Fraser Institute having some concern about that. Think what would happen, conversely, if the city of Vancouver decided to expel all the residents from the SROs. I think, again, there would be a justifiable wave of anger, an invocation of rights, and all that goes with it. But when the private sector does it, it becomes much harder to use that language. And that, to me, is a very important thing to bear in mind. I'd like to imagine another Mike Harcourt-like book written in, say, 2015, which celebrates the successful defense of the Downtown East Side from expulsion. To do so, I think, and it's possible, to do so, I think, we need, in part, to redefine how we think about urban change and the categories that we all too often uncritically use to bracket off certain areas or certain phenomena as political or as non-political. Thanks very much.